And Dan's computer has a problem. And it's
a lot of problems.
And they have this really great PowerPoint presentation that doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah.
PowerPoint presentation for Dan. So, but we will be posting your notes, and we will be posting your somewhat larger PowerPoint later on.
Okay.
Yes. That's very good. So I give you Dan time.
Cool. Thank you. Well, after that opening, you'll be disappointed to hear that I'm not an expert on Islam. I don't have a degree in Islamic studies or Arabic or any, you know, Middle East. I have to note that the average Muslim doesn't either. So, you know, I'm not an expert, and you won't be either after a few hours with us. But we'll give you some things to think about, introduce you to some sources, and you can explore these things on your own. And so this will be introductory. I mean, you can't really do justice to any major world religion in just a few hours together. And So this won't be exhaustive. There'll be some things we can't get to, but we'll try to at least be introductory, give you some sources and some things you can explore on your own. And this will be unabashedly from a Christian perspective. John and Amir and I, we're all Christians. We're speaking to an audience largely of Christians. So we're not pretending to come from a Muslim perspective. Or this is obviously Christian apologetics dealing with Islam. And so by the grace of God, since I am a Christian, that bias is acknowledged up front. So some of the purposes, this is kind of an educational setting. The Apologetics Research Society, we're an educational organization. And so our purpose mainly is to educate, give you some information, give you some sources you can explore. So that's our main focus, is doing that. The focus of the class actually isn't to upset Christians, to get Christians all scared and worried about the Muslim threat and world events and conspiracy theories of history. And, there's far too much in the Christian, professing Christian religious world, superstitious ideas, conspiracy theories about Islam. This is also not intended to upset Muslims. The point of this isn't to attack professing Muslims and there's far too much of that. If I may be fair to say, there's a little too much in the professing Muslim religious world, conspiracy theories about the West and about Christians, superstitious ideas. We don't want to feed into those either. And lastly, the purpose of this class isn't for Christians to upset Muslims. This isn't ammunition for you to go out or go online and attack, your Muslim friend. Some of this information is probably not things you would want to share, certainly not on a first meeting with someone. So it's a desire to build friendships with Muslims and have a little better idea of that worldview and where they're coming from. And so those are our purposes. And a vital thing, and you might have noticed this as well, we want to distinguish between the believers and the belief system. We were just talking about it. Ernesto and I were just talking about this morning. He's like, there's a lot of different Catholics out there. I mean, I grew up Catholic, but you see really dedicated Catholics, and you see some that are just kind of showing up to church. So you've got Roman Catholicism, the belief system, the theological system, but then you have Roman Catholics. I mean, there's all kinds of Roman Catholics. Some of them really support the Pope. Some of them disagree with the Pope. Some of them are pro-choice. Some are pro-life. If you want to find out what Roman Catholics believe, ask them. Just go to your Roman Catholic friend or neighbor or your aunt and ask them what they believe. You don't know what they believe from going to some class. But if you want to study Roman Catholicism, we can study that in a classroom setting. That's the belief system. That's what they probably should be believing and practicing, but you never know. And John Oakes has written a book on Mormonism. That's the belief system. And so we can study things about the belief system, but that doesn't tell you about every individual Mormon that you might meet. And the Mormonism, the belief system, we can study things about Joseph Smith. And he might have, the prophet of Mormonism, he might have done some very unsavory things in his life. That doesn't mean your average Mormon is that way. You know, there might be some dark things in the history of Mormonism, and there is. But that doesn't necessarily reflect on the typical Mormon guys that knock on your door. They're two different things. Now, obviously, the believers and the belief system are related, but they're not the same thing. And so when we talk about Islam today, the name of the class isn't Understanding Muslims. It's Understanding Islam. We're going to take just a brief look at the belief system. And but what you'll hear is someone says something about the belief system. Oh, Islam teaches X. And people will reply, well, my friend Ahmed doesn't think that. Well, you're talking about him. He's a professing Muslim. We're talking about the belief system. I mean, so if you want to know what your Muslim friend believes, just ask him. You know, take him out to coffee and find out what they believe. There's a lot of different professing Muslims, some very committed, some not. There's different sects of Islam, which we'll talk about today a little bit later. But we're going to focus on the belief system, giving you an insight on the worldview, on the belief system. This doesn't necessarily reflect on the believers that are out there, on professing Muslims. And so if we can do a thoughtful critique of Islam as a belief system, that's not attacking Muslims. There is a connection between the believers and the belief system, but you'll notice this in our world today, too. If you say anything, even if it's a fairly thoughtful, well-informed critique of Islam, people automatically see that as, how dare you attack all these sweet, peace-loving... That's not what we're doing. That's certainly not what we're doing today. But I think that'll be helpful for us today. And as you go out, keep those distinctions in mind, because people automatically tend to default to the believers. They want, hey, you need to treat believers with respect. And as Christians, we should. As Christians, we should be treating each person with respect. But something you'll often hear today is, hey, we need to respect everyone's beliefs. Really? If I run into, and there's not that many anymore, thankfully, but if I were to run into, in the backwoods of Kentucky, a Ku Klux Klansman, I want to treat him with respect. Do I have to treat his ideology with respect?
No.
I mean, so I think that's a vital distinction between the believers and the belief system. As Christians, we want to meet everyone with their dignity as people created in the image of God. But I don't have to respect every aspect of every belief system that's out there. In fact, there's things about certain belief systems that aren't respectable. And we should be fair in our criticism, but I think we have a right, you know, to critique those, you know, just thoughtfully be informed. And so that distinction, I think, will be helpful as we go out, but it'll be helpful today as well. We're focusing on Islam. There was actually a study that was done within the last several months. The Center for Middle East Policy, the Brookings Institute, they actually did a survey. It was an online survey, and it was weighted very heavily towards Christians. And they basically found that when asked how they felt about Muslim people, Americans overall had a more favorable view than unfavorable. In contrast, they have a more negative view of Islam. Americans who said they knew some Muslims well across the political spectrum tended to have much more favorable views of Muslims than those who said they didn't know any. Americans have a more unfavorable view of the Muslim religion, 37% favorable versus 61% unfavorable. So, out on the streets, we're already doing this. We're already distinguishing between the believers and the belief system. People are a little suspicious of Islam, even if they don't know much about it. People are generally pretty open and accepting of Muslims, even if they don't know much about Islam. But and the more Muslims they know, the more positive their opinion tends to be. So we're already kind of making that distinction anyway between the believers and the belief system. some books, our recommended reading for this class, Jesus and Islam, from our friend Doug Jacoby, and this postscript by Abdelaziz Sara, very powerful if you haven't read it, just a Palestinian brother that kind of responds to Doug's book and gives his own experience and just very moving account. This is a book called Answering Jihad, A Better Way Forward. This was actually published a couple months ago. So this is very current, and he talks about all the current issues about Syria and ISIS and refugees, all the controversial things. And Nabil Qureshi himself is a former Muslim, grew up in a Pakistani-American family, and came to Christianity a few years ago, and now speaks around the world, working on his doctorate in New Testament in England, and has a master's in religion focusing on Islam. And I've actually gotten to study under him a few different times. He's a great guy, and this is a very readable book. You can see by the size, it's pretty manageable, and he answers a lot of the current issues. So we won't today be getting into a lot of the politics and a lot of the current events, but this is a great exploration of that if you're wanting to dig into that. And we've got some other books up here that we'll probably mention, but I wanted to give a few introductory things on the sources for Islam. Now, we probably know that there's one major source for Islam, and this is the one everybody knows. We think, oh, well, Christians have the Bible and Muslims have the Quran. That's kind of the obvious one. That is supposed to be the literal word of Allah, and so it has a unique status for Muslims. But there are other sources, and so this first segment, I want to introduce those to you a little bit, because F.E. Peters, one scholar of the Middle East and Islam, he made a statement I thought just has really stuck in my mind. And how many people here have read the Quran or parts of it? Did you find that difficult at all to kind of a yeah? It's a challenging book, and F.E. Peters, he observes that, quote, the Quran is a text with no context. And there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, you can look at a passage in the Quran and kind of get the immediate context within that paragraph. But the Quran kind of rambles and covers all, and it's not clear who is talking. The Quran has 114 chapters. A chapter is called a surah, S-U-R-A. There's no standard way of rendering Arabic into English. So Arabic, obviously a different language. It's a very different alphabet and written language. The spellings fluctuate a little bit, but this is good. Yeah. Yeah. Going old school. So a surah is a chapter in the Quran. Plural is surat in the Arabic. But you'll hear English speakers like me saying surahs quite a bit. It's actually surat, but you'll hear me saying surahs because I'm kind of ADD that way. Arabic deficit disorder. So those are surat. And then verses in the Quran are called, a verse is an ayah, A-Y-A, and the plural is ayat. But you'll probably hear us saying ayahs, maybe, as English speakers. So there's 114 surat in the Quran. Generally speaking, they're arranged from the longest to the shortest. Not in chronological order, not any other thematic order. They're longest to shortest. I say generally speaking because Al-Fatiha, the first surah, is very short. It's just a little page. And then you think, hey, this isn't so bad. I think I can read through this whole thing. Then you hit surah 2, and, you know, once it goes over, you know, 100 verses, you know, after that first 100 ayat or so, you say, wow, I'm really in for it now. But the older Surat are in the latter part, I'm saying generally speaking, but the first half of the Quran are the more recent surahs, and the older ones, the shorter ones, are toward the back. That's very generally, because it's often hard to know what they're talking about, what they're referencing, but there's kind of a broad general consensus among Muslim scholars about that. And these were revelations allegedly revealed to the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century in Arabia over roughly 23-year period. But it is a, in many ways, a text without a context. And it's, generally speaking, supposed to be Allah speaking to Muhammad. And Muhammad then shares what Allah has revealed. I say generally speaking because sometimes it's not clear who's talking to who. Is it Muhammad? Is it Allah? And it's almost always unclear who they're talking to or who they're talking about. They're always talking about the unbelievers, the hypocrites. There's all these groups, and it's not clear who they're really talking about. And Tom Holland, one popular historian in England, says, quote, far from providing a roadmap of the prophet's life, the Quran was so dense, so elusive, so elliptical, as to require almost a roadmap itself. So we think we're going to, you know, we pick up the Gospels, read life of Jesus. We think we can pick up the Quran and maybe read the life of Muhammad. He grew up here and he talked to this guy and we see a chronological. But that's not what we find in the Quran at all. And yet it's supposed to be tied, supposedly, it's supposed to be tied into events in Muhammad's life. But if you don't know those events, it's not clear what's going on. And so there are other Islamic sources. This is The Life of Muhammad by Ibn Ishaq. It's in Arabic, it's the Sirat Rasul Allah. It's basically the life of the messenger of Allah. Rasul is messenger or apostle or of Allah. And this is the earliest, most authoritative biography of Muhammad. And this is the most authoritative English translation of it by Guillaume from Oxford University Press. 900 pages, so if you want some light reading and you don't mind wading through a lot of Arabic names, and if you're maybe a Game of Thrones fan, this, you know, really has something for everybody. You've got fighting and political intrigue for the men, for the ladies. You've got, you know, all kinds of soap opera type elements, you know, who's Muhammad sleeping with, and, you know, so it's got all of that in here. But so this goes into yeah, go ahead. Well, that's a complex story in itself. But this is this is the earliest one. The date is approximate, but it's 833 A.D. is kind of an approximate date for it. And so this is the leading in what's called the Sirah literature. Sirah, S-I-R-A. Plural, of course, would be Sirat. Sirah literature is biographical material on Prophet Muhammad. So if you want to know life of Muhammad, this is the earliest, most authoritative source, and so you have to go here first. Anybody that wants to write about Muhammad's life, if they want to do their research, they have to start here. This is the earliest source that we have. And after that, about 50 years after Ibn Ishaq did this, then you have Waqidi and Ibn Sa'd, and you have other writers writing about the life of Muhammad. But everybody has to kind of start with this. So this is kind of the king of the Sirah literature. There we go. And then you have the Hadith literature. Which is usually rendered H-A-D-I-T-H. Sometimes it's rendered in English H-A-D-E-E-T-H. But That's hadith. The plural in Arabic would be ahadith. And the hadith, these are stories and sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. So the hadith literature is basically, there are all these sayings, all these little episodes in the life of Muhammad. And these kind of grew over time. And eventually you have hadith collectors, hadith scholars that travel the Muslim world and try to collect all these. And so you know the Prophet's life and how he lived it. And this is the premier one, at least for Sunni Muslims, which Sunni Islam, that's 85% of the Muslim world. So the Shia have their own hadith collections. But this is Sahih al-Bukhari. Sahih means strong, means reliable. So some hadith are Hassan, which means kind of okay, and then there's Da'if, which means it's a weak hadith. It's not considered reliable. So al-Bukhari was this great scholar, this Persian scholar, and so he goes throughout the Muslim world and collects a lot of these stories and tries to put the strongest, most reliable ones that he thinks are reliable and collects them all together. There's several thousand of them. And then others will do this as well. But this is the premier one. This is not from Allah. This is not inspired. This is not divine revelation. This is not on the same level as the Quran, but it almost is. Because these are the stories and sayings of the Prophet Muhammad himself. And so they carry a certain authority in and of themselves. And so Sahih al-Bukhari, that's maybe second to the Quran, at least from a Sunni perspective. And it is the top, it is the gold standard of hadith literature. That's like the top one. And you have some other collections that come later. You can actually find these online. You can buy them in English translation, but you also have online where you can find that. It's amazing. For English speakers, this is more available than it's ever been. There are English translations, multiple ones of the Quran. And you go online and you can find Blue Letter Bible and Bible Gateway and all these sites where you look at different translations of the Bible. They have those for the Quran as well. And you can just Google it. There are different Quran browsers that are out there. You can look at different English translations. There's a website, sahih-bukhari.com. You can go and search that, and that's not the only site. There's another site called searchtruth.com, www.searchtruth.com. These are Muslim websites, essentially, Muslim sites or university websites where they post English translations of the hadith. The sirah is a little harder to find, but hadith literature, the Quran itself. I don't think it's on here, but you have something else called tafsir literature. Tafsir, spelled T-A-F-S-I-R, sometimes with a double E instead of the I. Tafsir literature is commentaries on the Quran. The Quran, as you've discovered, is a little hard to figure out what it's talking about, and so later generations of Muslims will basically start writing commentaries on the Quran.
Another question. Has Hadith or Quran ever been translated into Arabic? So in other words, for example, modern Arabs can't read this stuff, correct?
Well, the Quran is classical Arabic, so it's a little difficult.
But can a modern person speaking Arabic, can they pick up the Quran and read it and understand it?
It's very difficult because Arabic has changed over the last 1400 years. So you need some training to really get into the Quran itself. But interestingly, most Muslims today, you can find Bible studies all over the place, but you can find study Bibles, all over. You don't have a lot of Quran study groups or study Qurans. Now, there was recently a study Quran that came out, but there's lots of study Bibles. There's Bible study groups all over the world. The Quran really doesn't exist in Islam that way. The Quran itself, it's a sacred object, and it's meant to be recited. That's what the word Quran means. It means a recitation. It means a recital. It's an oral discourse. It's not really starting out as a book. It's something that's said. And so people memorize it in Arabic, because if it's not in Arabic, it's not a real Quran. It has to be in Allah's language, Arabic. And so a translation is a helpful study aid, particularly since most Muslims today don't speak or read Arabic, certainly not classical Arabic. So Muslims do translation as well, but if they memorize, they're reciting in Arabic. You memorize it and recite it, and it's not really something to be studied and that kind of thing. You just recite it, and you get barakah, you get blessings from Allah for reciting it. But the tafsir literature, these are commentaries, kind of like Bible commentaries. You know, you get into the context, linguistic issues, doctrinal issues, practical application. And the king of these is Al-Tabri, spelled T-A-B-A-R-I. Al-Tabri, great Persian scholar, and he was a polymath. He was a genius into mathematics and astronomy and all. And so he does the first major tafsir. And then he also will do something else. It's called tariq literature, which are like the histories. Tariq is like the, we won't get into that a lot today, but the tariq is history of the world according to Islam. So Al-Tabri has a 40-volume set of the histories, and it starts out with Allah's creation of the world and goes all the way to Muhammad, and there's several volumes on Muhammad, and then it goes a little farther into the early dynasties, you know, the early caliphs of Islam. And so Tabri, it's a 40-volume set, if you'd like to go out and buy that today. Now, I think there is a website where they have kind of a overview of it. So it's about 39 volumes, and then there's the 40th is actually an index. But so this is all available in English, though. This is an amazing thing, because this wasn't available for most of Muslim history. So if you were a Muslim, you would just do what your imam told you. The imam, at least in the Sunni tradition, is basically a prayer leader in the mosque, you know, sort of like a minister at a congregation. So you would, you know, the imam would lead you in prayer and the ritual prayers, and maybe give us some kind of lesson from life of Muhammad, and you just kind of took what your imam said, and you didn't have access to all this material. Yeah, Dan.
I would think a lot of people in Indonesia that are Muslim do not speak or read Arabic. Is that correct?
Yeah. But you learn to recite it in Arabic. Whether you understand what you're reciting, that doesn't matter. And it sounds like I'm joking, but it's true. It doesn't really matter. The important thing is you're reciting it in Arabic. I read one story of a Muslim, and he's called a Hafiz. He's someone who's memorized the entire Quran, and so he can recite it in Arabic. And
they do.
You can. And so someone's friend was a Hafiz, and he was like, can you do a little of Surah 3? And so the guy thinks for a second, and he's like, oh, la, la. You know, he goes through the whole thing, and he was like, okay, so what was that? He was like, I don't know. I don't know Arabic. You phonetically memorize it by rote, and then you can recite it. And Robert Spencer shares a similar story where I think it was a Pakistani man shared with him, hey, I'm a Hafiz now. I've memorized the entire Quran. He was like, well, congratulations. You know, what's next for you? He was like, next, I'm going to learn Arabic. It's something to be recited. And I'm not joking about that. That's the truth about how it exists. Yeah, go ahead. Right.
Is it just the history of Jesus, but it's God, you know, it's all of that that we sort of understand as Christianity. However, the Quran is not that premise.
No.
Because we look to the Bible for a direction in our
No, it's kind of working in a different way. Yeah, go ahead.
To kind of answer both questions, even if you understand modern standard Arabic and reading Quran, because of lack of context,
yeah. Yeah, because there's only one complete story.
That's what you rely on, half-seer.
Yeah, yeah. There's only one complete story in the Quran, the story of Yusuf, whom we would call Joseph. If you remember the story of Joseph at the end of the book of Genesis, that we get the whole story of Joseph in the Quran. Everything else is just mentioned. You get, you know, Noah kind of wanders in at one point, Ibrahim. You know, Abraham kind of comes in and comes out. And so it's always referencing these things and assumes you know kind of what who they're talking about. But, yeah, Ernesto.
How many authors or how many writers does the Quran have? Because the Bible only has so many writers.
Right.
John, Old Testament, Samuel. How many does the Quran have?
Well, the Muslim answer to that would be it's eternal. The Quran has existed in heaven with Allah for all eternity. And so Muhammad has basically recited it. He's learned it. And it's been written down. And so that's kind of a transcript of this eternal revelation. So from a Muslim perspective, it doesn't have an author. If you had to tie it, it's straight from Allah to Muhammad and just written down. And it's been faithfully preserved. It's been perfectly preserved, Muslims will tell you. Word for word, letter for letter, straight, direct download from Allah, and perfectly preserved to this day. Or so they say. But so this raises a good question of, like, well, we look to the Bible for some direction. And one thing, I think it was J. Smith that pointed out that for Christians, we actually have all these type of things. If we want to know the history of the world according to Christianity, well, that's basically the 66 books of the Bible. So we kind of have our own, we have our own Tariq in a sense. For Hadith, you know, the life and teachings of Jesus, we do have this is the Gospels. And the red letters, especially, you've got sayings of Jesus that have been passed down. You've got stories of Jesus saying and doing and different things and the history of his life. So we sort of have, in the Gospels, we have Sirah literature about Jesus. We have Hadith literature about Jesus. And then the rest of the New Testament is essentially the Tafsir, where they interpret and apply Jesus' life and teachings to other situations. And the book of Acts is kind of a little Tariq, a little church history there. So we actually have all these securely dated to the first century within the lifetime of eyewitnesses of the events. And we can study these. And these are all considered by Christians to be the inspired, inerrant, infallible, authoritative Word of God. These things aren't considered inspired or inerrant or any of that. It's the Quran that's the literal word of Allah. And something like Sahih Bukhari is pretty high up there, but no one would consider it divine. It has authority in that the divine man, Muhammad, is, his teachings and sayings are in there. Now, Muhammad himself is not considered divine, but this goes to your question, though. We look to the Bible for guidance and teaching, and the Quran isn't functioning in that same way. So where do they look? And Islam, they are looking to Muhammad. He's considered the perfect man, al-insan al-kamil in Islamic tradition. And there are a number of Quranic references to Muhammad. In Surah 33, Ayah 40, it says that he's the messenger of Allah. He is the seal of the prophets. He is the last and greatest of all the prophets that Allah has sent. Surah 33:21, Ayah 21, talks about Muhammad is an excellent example. Surah 2, Ayah 253, talks that Muhammad is exalted as a prophet. And He is the preferred one in Surah 17, Ayah 55, and sent as a mercy to the world in Surah 21, Ayah 107. And so every Muslim is called to follow the example of the perfect man, Muhammad. And this is 33:21 there. This is in Shakir's translation. Certainly you have in the Messenger of Allah an excellent exemplar for him who hopes in Allah and the latter day and remembers Allah much. Surah 68, Ayah 4 in the Shakir translation. And most surely you conform to sublime morality. And Surah 21, Ayah 107 says that Muhammad is a mercy to all creatures. Imam Al-Ghazali. Al-Ghazali is one of the great Muslim scholars. He died in the year 1111 on our calendar. A great Islamic scholar, and some rate him as the second greatest Muslim of all time. The first, obviously, being Muhammad. He was a scholar, and Al-Ghazali says, quote, "The apostle always prayed in all humility to Allah for bestowing on him the highest moral qualities and a generous character. He was of exceeding humility and the greatest, the bravest, the justest, and most pious of men. The high standard which the Prophet set in moral behavior as a citizen, free or persecuted, as a husband, as a chief, and as a conqueror, was never reached by any individual before or since." So this is the example that's held up. Once again, he's not considered God or divine. He's not how we picture Jesus as being God in the flesh. Muhammad is very clear in the Quran. He's a mere mortal. He's a human being. And yet he's got this exalted status. And so it's by, you don't really learn his life exactly from the Quran. And so that's where the Sirah literature, the Hadith literature, the Tafsir, the Tariq, that's where all these other Islamic sources come in to kind of fill in what's very unclear in the Quran. And so that's what I wanted to cover in my first segment. I don't know how we're doing on time, but okay. By a show of hands, has heard something or learned something you didn't already know? Okay. That's encouraging that I haven't been just, you know, telling these things you already know. And this was a surprise to me when I first, because I walked into a class years ago, and I thought it was just kind of Muhammad, the Quran, and, you know, it was just kind of a Jesus Bible kind of thing. It was just similar. And I didn't realize there were all these other sources that don't carry the same weight as the Quran, but they kind of fill in the gaps. The Quran itself is a little unclear, and so they built up this whole superstructure around it. And go ahead.
I read the Quran, well, half of it, about 15 years ago, because I worked with a Muslim, and he had told me that it was the most beautiful book ever written. So I thought, okay, let me read it.
Yeah.
And I was marking certain passages or ayats.
Yeah.
There's this common theme that seems to come back all the time that I've seen.
Right.
Is when you quote something and they don't like the quote, they say it's the Arabic, it's a bad translation. So is there really a trustworthy translation? Because I see these debates
right
on YouTube, on the television.
Yeah.
And that always seems to be the comeback. It's the translation is bad.
Yeah.
That's not what it means.
Yeah. And, luckily, there's a lot of good English translations of the Quran where you can, we're not stuck with one translation. You know, it's like the Bible. If you can't read the Bible in the original languages, then we should take advantage of as many good translations as possible and kind of compare and contrast and not locked into just one. And that's good with the Quran as well, to kind of see how different people do it. But that's kind of a standard response is, well, the Arabic Quran is the real Quran. These translations are just study aids. They're not the real deal. So that is kind of a common dodge that's used. But there are scholars, Muslim and non-Muslim scholars, that look at the Quran and kind of admit, yeah, there's some stuff that's not clear. There's stuff that's kind of ungrammatical. You know, there's little changes in it. So there's a lot. So the scholars that know the classical Arabic are like, no, it is pretty unclear. So another dodge with some of this other literature is someone will quote a hadith in some of these debates. Well, Muhammad on this occasion told Ibn Abbas this. And they're like, ah, that's a weak hadith. You can't trust that one. And it's like, well, no, this is from Sahih Muslim or Sahih al-Bukhari. This is from one of the top canonical collections. And they're like, oh, no, I don't. I think that's... So there's this tendency to kind of wave away whatever. And so that becomes an excuse, I think, a lot of times of, oh, that's a poor translation. I'm sure sometimes it is a poor translation, but... and then other times, like, oh, that's a weak. And there are a lot of hadith that are considered weak or whatever. And there doesn't seem to be there's supposed to be objective criteria by which they evaluate the hadith. It's called the ulum. It's the hadith sciences by which they evaluate strong and weak hadith. But when people look at it, it doesn't seem to be very objective criteria. It seems to be, well, does it agree with my school of Islam, and if I agree with it, it's strong. I hesitate to say this in an election year, but you hear this a lot. You hear this a lot today of, hey, I'm leading in all the polls. What about this poll? Well, I don't believe that poll. So there's a similar dynamic going on. The polls are strong unless I disagree with them, unless they throw a bad light on things. Then it must be weak. Yeah, but go ahead.
So when people are, if a person is a Muslim, they're professing the Islam religion. Is that accurate?
Or at least they've grown up in that religion.
So when they're doing their prayers, depending on where they live, whatever, are they reciting the Quran? Is that what they're doing? They're reciting one or more of the surah? Is that what their prayers are?
It's a lot of that is from the later traditions, like the Hadith. Like the five daily prayers, I'm not going to get a lot into the five pillars. John might a little bit. The five pillars of Islam, Andrew Rippon, a scholar in Canada, has noted, it seems like all five of the five pillars developed later, like 9th century. So these are part of the Hadith and other literature. Yeah. Yeah. So in the Quran, you don't find a lot of... the Quran talks about charity and giving to the poor, giving to widows and orphans. But the zakat, that's one of the five pillars, that's not specifically in the Quran. Then the five daily prayers, the Quran talks about three daily prayers. The idea of five daily prayers is later Islamic tradition. And even the Shahada, which is the confession that Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet, which if you're converting to Islam, that is what you're supposed to recite in Arabic. You have to say it in Arabic and you have to mean it. There's niyyah, there's intention. So you have to be sincere in saying it. That confession, the Shahada, that's the first of the five pillars. But those exact words don't really appear altogether in the Quran. There's not a Quranic passage that says, say this prayer and pray Allah into your heart. I mean, it's not in there in the Quran. Although Al-Fatiha, the first surah, is a prayer. And there are elements of that that are in some of these other things. But these five pillars... fasting in Ramadan, that was already practiced. Ramadan was already a sacred month in the Islamic calendar. Doing the Hajj to Mecca, that pilgrimage was already being done according to the Sirah and other Muslim sources. And so the Muslims are kind of adopting the Psalm, the fast during Ramadan, and the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca. And I think I've mentioned most of those, except there's an unofficial sixth pillar there at the bottom. This actually is talked about in the Quran, in the Hadith, and you actually do see this in the life of Muhammad. You don't really see Muhammad strictly following any of these five pillars. This unofficial sixth one, jihad, you do see in the life of Muhammad. So it's not considered one of the five pillars, but strangely, it's more resonant with the Quran and the life of Muhammad than any of the other five. But, go ahead. Yeah.
It sounds like in Islam they are inclusive, so they pull these six pillars into it.
The five pillars are kind of built on top of like Quran and life of Muhammad, and because when you look at the Quran and the life of Muhammad, you really don't see the five pillars being consistently practiced or consistently taught, which I'm not saying that makes them wrong or bad, or it's just these are things that have developed later. And kind of, yeah, it kind of is like a plan of salvation. Or these are obligatory duties for Muslims, the five pillars. But interestingly, if they're supposed to pattern their life after Muhammad, you really don't see him doing all of these. Because there are certain rules. During the Hajj, you're not supposed to get married. You wear the ihram, you know, the certain dress for the Hajj, and you're not supposed to marry, and there's other certain. But Muhammad actually got married when he did Hajj at one point. And you really, it's not enjoined to do the five daily prayers. You don't really see Muhammad doing that. Maybe he was doing three. That's what the Quran talks about. He was practicing the prayers. He was doing acts of charity, and he would help people out. I don't know if it's actually the zakat, which is the almsgiving, the confession, that never really appears in those. So these are just kind of added on later. As I said, it's if Muhammad's the example that we're all to follow, and then Muslims are all to follow this, it's like, well, he didn't do all these, but which you'll see that's a consistent pattern, actually, with Muhammad. But
they don't think that way.
No.
They include all these other things.
And to be fair, the average professing Christian doesn't know the Bible that well, let alone the Quran. The average professing Muslim doesn't know the Quran and the Hadith and all that well. And the Bible, even less. Most have not read the Bible. It'd be a matter of serious study to, you know, go into all that.
To respond to Steve's and Ernest's question, the underlying ideology which Muslims use as defense for when it comes to contradictions or translation is that the miracle of Islam is that Quran has never been modified. It's been, as you
right.
said, it's original, and that's what they're kind of against, that transition. That, you know, that's not, show me the real one where, you know, we can't find. So that's why they're like,
yeah.
You can't even question that. Unless you're being disowned by, you know, as a Muslim, you're not a Muslim if you deny that the miracle of Islam.
Yeah.
And especially because Muhammad was not literate, so they're like, why an illiterate person was able to receive God's word and bring it to us. So.
Okay, we'll call time there. And when do we start back up? Like
start
10 minutes?
About 8 minutes.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
You love.
Can we time this off?
It was
cool.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Hey, Dan.
Oh.
Good
to see
hello.
You again.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for doing what you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
Good stuff. I'll grab you a little bit later.
Okay.
Table, and we do want everybody to register to that beautiful lady back there near the registration table. No, that one over there, actually. No, the registration table over there. All right. And you have books, yes.
All right. When Dan's done... Amir Zabeti is going to be sharing his story from having grown up in a Muslim background and a little bit about his life. So, okay, go ahead, Dan. Excuse
me. All right. This you probably recognize as Arabia. It's covered up by a book. Let's
go down two slides.
There we go. Arabia, prior to the coming of Islam with Muhammad, We really don't have a lot of what Kesia Ali at Boston College calls context history. The things in the Bible, we do have a lot of, there's a lot we don't know. We still have a lot we need to learn, but you have a lot of context history for the events of the Old and New Testament, because we know Egyptian history, we know Roman history, Babylonian history, and, you know, with archaeology and manuscript evidence, we know history of all these different cultures where these things the Bible describes happened. And so that gives us some insight into the scriptures, even though the events of the Bible happened thousands of years ago in another culture. It kind of helps us reconstruct it. We don't just have the 66 books of the Bible. We can kind of get the historical background a little bit. And Arabia was a very uncivilized place, so there weren't a lot of written records. It is it was an oral culture of memory. It was a pre-literate society, so not very much in the terms of inscriptions or manuscripts. And it wasn't an incredibly civilized place. And so, you know, when you have the events of the New Testament happening in the Roman Empire, there's lots of documentation and there's, you know, cities we can go to. And Arabia wasn't that kind of place. And a few years ago, we did a day on Islam like this. I won't go in as much detail as I did then on kind of pre-Islamic Arabia. But we just have never known that much about Arabia prior to Islam. Most of our information has come through Muslim sources. And so we've just had to accept those sources at face value and go with that, which was fine. That's what we had to go on. But we're slowly learning more and more. And as Christians, we're learning more and more. I mean, the Dead Sea Scrolls in the 20th century was a great bit of context history for the Old and New Testament and what was going on between the Old and New Testament times. And so there's more to be discovered. So we're learning more and more things about Arabia back in those days. What I'm giving you is mainly the traditional narrative of Islam. And there's things we could look at deeper into it. But the traditional story is, it might sound offensive that I describe it as an uncivilized place, but that's basically the Muslim story about Arabia. It was very barbaric, uncivilized, full of pagan idolatry and immorality. The people weren't looking out for the poor. And then Muslims came and kind of cleaned up the place. You know, you think it's bad now? You should have seen it before we got here. We've really raised the standards a little bit for Arabia and surrounding areas. And, you know, we started from the bottom, now we're here. You know, it's that kind of, you've heard that kind of reasoning before. So Arabia, it was, you know, there's these different settlements. It was what Timothy Tennant calls a land of traders and raiders. The traditional narrative was you had trade routes just here at the bottom in Yemen. You'd have trade routes where ships would come in and they would go up the west coast of Arabia. So there's these trade routes that go up, or at least that's the story. And so you would have caravans taking goods up to the Near East and the Mediterranean world, coming from China and India, or at least that's the story. And so they're going up. You've got these caravans going through the desert. And that's a way that you can make some money, you know, hauling freight through the desert. But you've got smaller tribes and stuff. And there's other ways to, you know, make a profit in that environment. Raiding the caravans. And those are called Ghazi, like caravan raiders. And so that would go on. And then it turns into a little bit of a protection racket. Hey, it's a nice caravan you got here. It'd be a shame if something was to happen to it. You know, so there was a little bit of that going on. You always wanted to have, you know, you had your caravan and you wanted a security detail to go with it. And you'd like pay people off along the way. So that was kind of how it was. There wasn't a lot of indigenous industries, although in the northern Arabia, you do have date palms that grow, and you have some Jewish tribes up there. in Yathrib, which will later be known as Medina, the city of the prophet. And so there's some agricultural areas, but most of it is Central Arabia is the world's largest desert. So it's nomads, and there's not a lot there. So the traditional narrative is that there was a city called Mecca, and there was something there called the Kaaba, which basically is Arabic for cube. And so there's the cube that's there, which might excite some Transformers fans. I don't know that there's the cube, but it's a black thing, and it is the holy house. It is kind of a central place of worship. That's the Kaaba, that black cube right there. This is how it looks today. You've had the sacred mosque kind of built around it. And this was probably not the only sacred place like this in ancient Arabia. But so you had Mecca, the city, and they have the Kaaba there. And inside the black cube are there were said to be 360 gods, 360 idols, one for every day of the year, because it's a lunar calendar. Ah, you see, you got me, almost got me. Okay, so it's so on a lunar calendar, it would be that many. But you have, allegedly, there was an idol of Jesus. There was an idol of the Virgin Mary. So everybody could go there and worship their respective god. And the area, the sacred precincts around the Kaaba were considered haram, which means forbidden. There was no bloodshed of man or animals allowed within those sacred precincts. And so, as the traditional narrative goes, this made it a good place for peaceful, free trade, because there was no fighting allowed in the vicinity of the Kaaba. And there were sacred months. Ancient Arabia was it was a stateless society. There was no central government, but there was kind of a common culture. There was a common language of Arabic. There were some common traditions, and some of their traditions were that there were sacred months. There were several sacred months throughout the year. Ramadan was one of those, and during the sacred months, it was haram to attack caravans. There was no fighting amongst tribes. You were not supposed to be attacking caravans, because it's a sacred month where people do pilgrimage. They go to places like the Kaaba to worship their respective gods. And as the story goes, there was a tribe that really benefited from all this trade. They were the keepers of the Kaaba, called the Quraysh tribe. So this is a consortium of clans. That was basically the form of government in Arabia. There were some kingdoms there, but mainly it's tribalism. And it's one of the oldest, it's a local form of government, a very limited form of government. It's probably the oldest form of government. And it's still fairly common today, even in places that allegedly are modern nation states. If you remember during the Iraq War, Saddam Hussein hid from coalition forces where? Near Tikrit, his hometown, with his home tribe. And the surge that coalition forces did in Iraq was basically making alliances with tribal leaders in Iraq, and tribes tended to follow the tribal chieftain, and so if you get the tribal leaders on your side, you can do things. So there's still that tribalism kind of underlying even our modern age. It's just you have your family, families make up clans, clans make up tribes. So you have the Quraysh tribe. They're the keepers of the Kaaba, and they are benefiting from all this trade. And so the traditional origins narrative of Islam is that this was a major trading city on the trade route. And so there was a lot of business. And so the Quraysh tribe wants to keep this going. They want the Kaaba to remain as it is. They want the cash flow to keep coming in. And Muhammad is born. All dates on this are approximate, but he is born in 570 AD, the year of the elephant, because there was an elephant, or maybe more than one elephant. There was a king in Yemen that sent this army to invade Mecca, and so that was the big thing that happened that year, I guess. But so the year of the elephant, and Muhammad is born, and so he is born, and he is part of the Quraysh tribe, but he is part of the Hashim clan. They are Hashemites, and so this is a smaller, less wealthy, less well-connected clan within the Quraysh tribe. So it's a little confusing. You hear some accounts, the Quraysh, they were ruling the roost, and he was one of the Quraysh. But then you have other accounts of Muhammad kind of being a poor kid and growing up. But that kind of resolves the contradiction. He was part of the Hashim clan. And so Muhammad is born. The story goes that his father, Abdullah, is coming in from the fields because Al-Tabri and some of the different sources, even Ibn Ishaq, they describe Mecca as this grassy, fertile valley that's cultivated and irrigated. And Abdullah is coming in from a hard day in the fields, you know, because they have vineyards and grapevines and olives and all these things. And he's coming in, but he's still got clay and loam and, you know, dirty from time in the fields. So he comes in to see his wife, and she's like, you got to clean up first, you know, get out of here. So, this is Arabia, so he just goes to his second wife, and, you know, after he cleans up, and his second wife, Amina, she becomes the mother of Muhammad, you know, as a result of this. And, Abdullah dies, like shortly before or shortly after, the sources vary, but he dies, and so Muhammad grows up without his biological father, according to the sources. And when he is born with his mother, Amina, she basically gives him to a wet nurse. She basically has a nanny that nurses him and raises him. So his biological mother doesn't have a lot of contact with him. Might have been some reasons for that, but then his mother, Amina, dies in 576. And so then he's off to his grandfather. And this is a patriarchal society. It's very much about the guys and being tied in with your father. And so he didn't have his father. Now he doesn't have his mother. He's with his grandfather. And 578, his grandfather dies. And now he is with his one of his uncles, Abu Talib, and he's going to basically grow up with him. And Abu Talib's son, Muhammad's cousin, is Ali. And Shia Muslims trace back to Ali. And Shia basically means the party of Ali. And so they trace back to Muhammad's cousin, who eventually become Muhammad's son-in-law. So almost like a son, almost like an adopted son. Muhammad will grow up with them. He's kind of been shepherding through this time, just working as a lowly shepherd. And his uncle takes him on a caravan trip to Syria. And so he does that. So then he's kind of involved in running caravans. And there's a wealthy widow named Khadija. She's a widow. She's been widowed at least once, perhaps twice. And she's a cousin. She's also in the Quraysh tribe. And so she has inherited this caravan business. And she has Muhammad take her caravan. He comes back, and she kind of likes the cut of his jib, kind of how he handles things. Seems like a, you know, good young man. And she proposes marriage. And Muhammad accepts. He's about 25 years old at the time. She's in her 40s, maybe 50s, depending on the sources. And by all accounts, it's a, you know, it's a good marriage. She is his only wife. And Now Muhammad finds himself this poor guy that's never had strong family connections and always had this hard scrabble existence, you know, a shepherd and a caravan and just working. Now he finds himself comfortably well off, and so he doesn't really have to take caravans anywhere anymore. And he explores more spirituality. Now, they had in the Islamic picture is that Arabia was completely idolatrous, completely pagan, and Muhammad brought the belief in one God. But even if you just look at the Islamic sources, you see that there were Jews living in Arabia. You see that there were Christians living in Arabia. Now, if you remember the map, up to the west would be the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire on its last legs, ravaged by plague, by barbarians, and also fighting the Sasanian Empire to the east, which is the Persians. So the Muslim sources will refer to them as the Persians, the Sasanian Empire. Most of them are, there's one religion there, Zoroastrianism, Fred Donner describes it as quasi-monotheistic, not quite, but there's Zoroastrians there among the Persians. And among the Romans, there is a religion. There's one major religion, Christianity, and they will refer to that as the Christians, the Romans or the Christians. We would look at that as Roman Catholicism as kind of the dominant thing, but there were smaller groups like the Copts there in Egypt. But so you have these great world empires, and each one has their own religion with one God, and they influence Islam or Arabia a little indirectly. But if you are a heretic or a cultist or a sectarian, or if you're just kind of an unorthodox religious person, Arabia is a pretty attractive option to get away from persecution and oppression in those greater empires, to escape temptation, to escape taxation, many things that you might want to avoid among these empires. And so you got a lot of non-traditional representatives of Christianity and Zoroastrianism and these other religions. And so they're present in Arabia as well. So you have some other monotheists, Jews, Christians, and some of these other Zoroastrians, Sabians. And then you have what are called Hanifs. The Hanifa are basically, have you ever met somebody that is like, yeah, I believe in God, I pray, but I'm not into organized religion, I don't... That's what these people are. Hanifa are worshipers of one God, but they're not Jews, Christians, they're not involved in any of the major religious groups. They believe there's one God and we should worship him. And apparently Muhammad has influenced this. He's perhaps a Hanif of sorts, and he would go to Mount Hira, which is near Mecca, and he would spend the month of Ramadan up on the mountain, and that was his time to pray and meditate, and there was a cave up there, and so he's in the cave, and in the year 610, when he's about 40 years old, is what is called in Islam the Night of Power. Sometimes called the Night of Power or Decree. This is when he has a very powerful religious experience. Muhammad is in this cave, and they know the actual cave where this is supposed to have happened. Although the cave itself is kind of a hole in the ground, it's maybe 5 feet wide, 11 feet long. It's hard to imagine what would a man do just being in this hole in the rocks. But so he's there at night in the darkness, the cold of the mountain, and he feels a presence, a spiritual presence in the cave with him. And he feels a pressure, like the presence is crushing him. And the presence says, Ikra, which means to recite or to read, because reading in those times, you are reciting. That's rote memorization was how you learned. Most people who read, you're reading aloud. Sometimes it's translated read, but recite is probably a better translation. So this spirit tells him to recite, and he's feeling this pressure. He's feeling crushed. He's like, I have nothing to recite. because according to traditional Islam, he was illiterate. He could neither read nor write. He hadn't been educated in these ways where you're reciting things and memorizing things. And it asks him again, recite. And he says, I have nothing to recite. And then it asks him a third time, and he says the same thing. And then the voice speaks to him. This is from Life of Muhammad. It says, recite in the name of thy Lord who created man of blood coagulated. Recite the Lord is most beneficent, who taught by the pen, taught that which they knew not unto men. And then the spirit leaves. And Muhammad, according to Ibn Ishaq, and I awoke from my sleep, and it was as though these words were written on my heart. Now none of God's creatures were more hateful to me than a poet or a man possessed. I could not even look at them. I thought, woe is me, poet or possessed. Never shall Quraysh say this of me. I will go to the top of the mountain and throw myself down, that I might kill myself and gain rest. So I went forth to do so, and then, when I was midway on the mountain, I heard a voice from heaven saying, O Muhammad, thou art the apostle of God, and I am Gabriel. I raised my head towards heaven to see who was speaking, and lo, Gabriel in the form of a man, with feet astride the horizon, saying, O Muhammad, thou art the apostle of God, and I am Gabriel. So this is, this spirit claims to be Jibril, which is Arabic for Gabriel. And Jibril is the angel from Allah. And so this is allegedly the same angel that spoke to Mary that she was going to give birth to Jesus and carried messages in the Bible. And but you notice Muhammad's response. He is very disturbed, and his response is to commit suicide, to jump off a mountain and be free of this spirit. And that's not only in Ibn Ishaq, the Sirah literature, but that's in the Hadith literature as well, that there's multiple times after this that Muhammad will go into the mountains and will be contemplating jumping off a cliff to be rid of this spiritual presence. He's afraid he's possessed by a demon or maybe by a jinn. And we know those as genies in our culture, but they believe very strongly in the jinn, and the jinn are mentioned in the Quran. That is, Muslims believe in angels and demons and the jinn. The jinn aren't angels. They're a different kind of spirit creature. But Muhammad has this experience and doesn't really know what to make of it. But his wife Khadija reassures him. She has a cousin who's a Nestorian Christian who reassures him, hey, you sound like you could be a prophet. You could really be a prophet. So they reassure him. He still has these, this goes on for a couple years that he has some times he almost commits suicide. The spirit will return to him and recite things, and he will memorize them and learn to recite them. And so he has kind of this goes on for a couple years, and then he goes public and begins to start preaching in Mecca. And he's a doomsday prophet. He's preaching hellfire and brimstone, repentance from idolatry, from not caring about the poor. And this really isn't a problem. You can preach whatever God you want. You can worship any god in Mecca. But he's kind of attacking the establishment, and after a while he begins to say, no, Allah is not just one of many gods. Allah is the one and only true God. All these other gods are false gods. Now, so this is already, this is starting to create a problem, because the Quraysh want the status quo to be maintained. And Muhammad received some persecution. It's verbal abuse and some, there's an account of one guy grabs him at one point, and his uncle Hamza kind of defends him. And so Muhammad never really gets hurt in any of this, but some of his followers do, because eventually he starts to accumulate followers. It kind of starts out with family, friends, and it's a lot of the poor and disenfranchised that come to him. He never ends up with a lot of followers, but there starts to be a following that are, you know, praying with him, and so he starts, Abu Bakr, is a lifelong friend of his, and Umar, becomes a friend of his, this goes on, and the Quraysh are really offering him anything he wants to basically stand down. And he's being criticized, and this is supposedly some of the Quranic verses are talking about this criticism, because they're saying, well, you're a prophet of Allah, well, do a miracle for us. He's like, in the Quran, he's like, well, the Quran is my miracle. How could one guy just dream up all these wonders? And remember, the Quran's not a book, it's a recitation. And so Muhammad is there. Well, my proof is these wonderful things I'm reciting. Who could come up with this on their own? These must be from Allah. So this is what Professor David Wood calls the argument from literary excellence. That's the apologetic for the Quran. Doesn't this stuff sound great? Yeah, my religious poetry is better than your religious poetry. Therefore, I'm a prophet of God. Which at the time, people really weren't buying that. I can tell many of you aren't buying that either, but you can imagine in the Quraysh, people just really, for the most part, weren't buying that, because you had poets, which were mentioned in what I just read. You had poets in Arabia, so it wasn't total barbarism as Muslim and other sources might paint it. You also had poetry contests, and tribes would rejoice when a poet was born among them, someone who had the gift of gab and could create and memorize and recite these great things. So you had poets, you had oral storytellers called kusas that would tell stories, the tellers of tall tales that would, so Muhammad was accused of being a poet. You're not a prophet, you're just some poet, you're plagiarizing. In fact, you're not a poet. You're plagiarizing from some legit poet out there. You had Al-Nader Al-Harif, who had done some trading in Persia, and he was like, all Muhammad is doing, talking about Moses and Ibrahim and all these guys, he's just reciting stories of the ancients. And this criticism appears in the Quran. Al-Nader says, he's just reciting stories of the ancient. I can tell better stories than he does. And then Al-Nader would go on and recite this whole tale from that he had heard in Persia. There was even in Eastern Arabia, there was someone known as Musalima about the same time in Eastern Arabia. Musalima claimed to be a prophet. And he was reciting things that he claimed to be from Al-Rahman, which his God. And he was doing these recitations and gathering a little bit of a following. And when people asked for a miracle, Muslima could do things like he put an egg inside a bottle. Something. So he actually did a little more than, hey, these recitations, who can think up stuff this good? It must be divinely inspired. He, one-upped it a little bit with, the egg in the bottle, and he could probably do the Chinese linking rings and the ball in the cup trick, and is this your card, sir? He may have some other miracles to his name, I don't know. So you had other people doing some of these, and so Muhammad actually Ibn Ishaq talks about Muslima in here. He's, of course, considered a liar. Muslima is a false prophet, Muhammad is the real one. So Muhammad receives mostly verbal abuse. He doesn't receive a lot of followers. There's some physical abuse to some of his followers, but not really to Muhammad himself, because Muhammad still has his uncle. He still has his uncle Talib, who basically sticks up for him among the other Quraysh, among the respected leaders in the tribe. And so he's under the shield of his uncle, and also Khadija somewhat, a very respected woman, and he's got that wealth. 617, the Meccans do the boycott. They were like, no one is going to do business with any of Muhammad's people. We're not going to do any business with them. We're going to not do any business with anyone who does business with them. We're not going to intermarry with them. So this is an attempt to choke out the Muslim movement. Now, this doesn't work. They manage, you know, black market. You know, they manage to get through this, through the boycott. They suffer somewhat through it. In 619, Khadija dies. And she was, by all accounts, the love of his life. She was his, you know, favorite wife. He will have others after this, but she was always the highest in his estimation. In 619, they've made it through the boycott, but Khadija dies and Abu Talib dies. So Muhammad no longer has the protection of his uncle. He no longer has the comfort of Khadija, the moral support and the financial support. And this is a time of persecution. The persecution is going to heat up now that that's happened and the boycott hasn't worked. So Muhammad, this is the Muslim calendar. The Islamic calendar doesn't date to the life of Muhammad. It dates to the Hijra, which is spelled various ways. The Hijra in 622, this is the first year of Islam. The Hijra is when the Muslims leave and they go north to a city called Yathrib, which will later and from then on, even today, be known as Medina, the city of the Prophet. So he goes to Yathrib. Yathrib is in this agricultural area in the north. Date palms are kind of what they grow. So they have three very successful Jewish tribes there in Yathrib. But then you have some pagans, some non-Jewish Arabs that live there. These tribes are in conflict. There's a lot of friction between the tribes in Yathrib. So Muhammad has basically negotiated a deal with them. They've heard that, you know, he's a pretty fair man, he can come up there and kind of mediate the disputes. You know, if they'll offer a home to Muhammad and his people, then he will live up there and he will kind of help them get along. He'll kind of be almost the de facto ruler of the city. And this seems good to them because the Jews see Muhammad, he's an Arab, but he's a fellow monotheist. He's not like these other Arabs worshiping idols and all these things. They see him as a fellow monotheist. And he's shown a lot of respect at that time for Judaism. If you look at the halal food laws of Islam, they're very similar to kashrut, to kosher food laws in Judaism. And Jews, if you remember the book of Daniel, Daniel is saying his prayers facing Jerusalem every day, even though Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed at that time. And the temple once again is destroyed, and you know Jerusalem is in a different status now. But Muhammad, they pray facing Jerusalem, the holy city of the Jews. And so the Jews feel like we have kind of a kindred spirit here in Muhammad, whereas the other tribes, they feel like, well, Muhammad, he isn't a Jew. He's a fellow Arab like us. I think we can deal with this guy. So this is kind of their plan. But Muhammad has come with 100, maybe as many as 200 people. Most of them are unschooled, unskilled, poor people. They've left their families behind. And so Muhammad has basically become a chieftain of this super tribe. And because they've left their families and their livelihoods behind. And so now you have all these people there that with really no means of supporting themselves, they've left everything behind to follow Muhammad. And so on the surface, this looks like this should be a time of peace. Yathrib is like 200 miles north of Mecca. So the Meccans think we've gotten rid of this troublemaker at last. And everyone in Yathrib is thinking, well, now, you know, Muhammad has gotten away from his troubles there in the south and everything can settle down. They make a mutual non-aggression pact, sometimes retroactively called the Constitution of Medina. Basically means we're not going to fight each other, and anybody that attacks one of the tribes here in Medina, then all of us are going to attack that person. So they kind of make an alliance. So it looks like things should end very peacefully. But Muhammad doesn't want peace. The Meccans have insulted him and his God, and now he's got all these people looking to him and no means to support themselves. So Muhammad, the caravan trader, becomes a caravan raider. And so he sends his Ghazis out to attack the caravans, and they start doing that to earn a living, and they do it with some bloodshed at the Nakhla. It's called the Nakhla raid, because ideally, this is a tribal culture. You don't want to get other tribes mad at you, especially if you're a smaller tribe, because then it's a blood feud. So ideally, if you're raiding a caravan, you ambush them, surround them, get them to surrender, and then you ransom them back to their tribe. So you try to do it with a minimum of bloodshed. I'm not saying there never was, but ideally, you know, you capture them, and then you sell them back to their people, and it's all, you've got all their stuff. And so ideally, you do it that way. Muhammad's people actually kill some Meccans in a caravan raid, the Nakhla raid. This raid takes place during the sacred months when there's not supposed to be any caravan raiding. And the guys come back with their spoils of war. Muhammad, according to the sources, is a little ambivalent about this, but he inquires of Allah, and Allah reveals to him that what the Meccans did to you, that was way worse than killing somebody in the sacred months. These Meccan idolaters, what they did to you guys, you know, killing someone in a sacred month is nothing compared to that. Don't worry about that. So Muhammad basically has got things going with the Meccans again, and he's gathered a little bit of a following among the Ansars, the Arabs that have converted to Islam there in Medina, and So Muhammad is doing this raiding, and there's some battles, the Battle of Badr, and I won't get into all the battles here for, just for the sake of time. But the Meccans start sending armies north to Medina, and some of these battles go well for the Muslims, some of them don't. But they have these pitched battles, and Muhammad's following is growing. Eventually, he negotiates a ceasefire with Mecca, like a 10-year ceasefire, and so then he can turn his attention north. He's no longer going to be attacked from Mecca, from the south. So he starts hitting the Jewish tribes up in Khabar and other places. And the reason I mention Khabar is because something happens there. They take over the city and torture some of the leaders of the city to give away where they've hidden their, you know, the treasures of the city. And there's a captive that's taken, a very beautiful teenage girl that's the bride of one of the leaders. And she is married to Muhammad because Muhammad got a fifth of everything up front. So he got the first pick of the women because he's Allah's apostle. And so he has her, and she has nowhere else to go anyway. Her husband and father have been killed. And so that happens. And then there's another, a Jewish woman there. Khabar was a Jewish settlement. A Jewish woman there says, well, she essentially says, you guys have won fair and square. How about we just have a big banquet? I'm going to do a banquet for all you guys. So Muhammad agrees to this, and he's... they're eating the lamb, and Bishr, who is one of Muhammad's companions, notices there's a funny taste to this lamb. But he notices Muhammad is still eating, so the prophet's still eating, so it's no big deal. And then Muhammad says, this leg of lamb has informed me that it is poisoned. And they drag in the woman, the Jewish woman, and who has made this dinner for them. And they were like, why did you do this? And she said, well, you you killed my father, you killed my husband, and I thought if you're a prophet, you would be able to know that it was poison, and if you were not a prophet, if you're just a king, then we'd be rid of you. And Muhammad accepts that reason and sends her out to be killed. And he survives, and Bishr dies, and so Muhammad continues conquering, and then he sends his armies down to Mecca and surrounds Mecca. They did not expect this, and so the city is surrounded, and Muhammad says, if you don't resist, it's basically Mecca folds. He's worn them down, and they Mecca gives up, and it's a relatively peaceful takeover. I say relatively, I mean by Muslim standards, it was relatively peaceful. Because Muhammad said, stay in your houses, don't resist, you won't be harmed, except for these people that are my enemies. And, or you can go to the Kaaba. If you go within the sacred precincts of the Kaaba, you won't be killed. And one of Muhammad's enemies goes there, he's hanging on to the Kaaba, and Muhammad's men come in there and kill him anyway. So it's a relatively peaceful takeover by Muslim standards. So now Muhammad is kind of the power in Arabia. He's taken over Mecca, and then that will be followed by a year of embassies where the people come. Other tribes in Mecca kind of see where the wind is blowing here. We'll just, give up. And so Muhammad, at the end of his life, is the lord of Central Arabia, basically. And how are we doing on time?
2 minutes.
Okay. But Muhammad, let me see if I have the quote here. Yeah, he dies in, he will die in Medina. Yeah, in 632. But Muhammad ultimately will die in Medina. He does a final Hajj and all that. But he feels a lingering sickness from the poison in Khabar. In Al-Bukhari, he says, the Prophet in his ailment used to say, Aisha, I feel the pain caused by the food I ate at Khabar. My aorta is being cut from that poison. Elsewhere in Bukhari, it says, Aisha said, Allah's apostle in his fatal illness used to ask, where will I be tomorrow? Where will I be tomorrow? Aisha, he had married right before the Hijra. Aisha was the daughter of his friend, his companion, Abu Bakr. She was, so I think I have that. It's on another page. But he goes to Abu Bakr and says, Allah in a dream told me that your daughter was going to be my wife. Abu Bakr, according to Bukhari, says, but you're my brother. And Muhammad says, yes, we are brothers in religion and in Allah's book, but we're not, physical brothers. So it's, it's okay. She was 6 years old at the time. And this is, you can't dispute this from the Muslim sources. So Muhammad marries her at six. He's around 53 years old at this time. And they consummate the marriage when she's nine. And this is in the Hadith. This is in all the Muslim sources. She will become his favorite wife, his child bride. And not more than Khadija. She was very aware that she was in the shadow of Khadija her whole life. And his other wives, which he acquired in battle in different ways, they very much know they're in the shadow of Aisha. She is, his favorite wife among all of them. So these are hadiths from Aisha about, so he dies in her arms in Medina, claiming it is from this poison. You can feel it in his heart, in his aorta. And so, quick summary. Abu Bakr, Aisha's father, he's the companion. He'll take over after Muhammad and be the caliph, the Muslim leader of the Muslim community. Now, there were a lot of people that thought Ali should be the leader because he's Muhammad's family. He's son-in-law, his cousin. And so the party of Ali is the Shia. They trace to Muhammad's family and Ali. They think he should have been in charge. But everyone else, Sunni Islam, seeks to follow the Sunnah of the Prophet. That's the example of Muhammad. So you basically take the Sirah and the Hadith, and you get the Sunnah. You get the example of Muhammad. So Sunni Muslims follow that. And so Abu Bakr becomes the first caliph. He dies. Umar will be the second caliph. Then it will go to Uthman, which we'll talk about later. And then Ali finally becomes caliph. And these are the four righteous caliphs. Al-Rashidun, what they call the four rightly guided caliphs of the Muslim empire. But we should stop now and let...
Actually going to take a break in about 150 minutes because we're going to have a brother who's going to be sharing his testimony. Thanks, Dan.
Good? Okay. Can you hear me? Yep. All right. Good morning. My name is Amir Zabedi. And I'm actually from the, my wife and I, Maria, we live in Orange County. We're from the metro LA region. Of the church, and my wife actually wanted to be here this morning, but she had a really bad neck ache, so that's why she didn't make it. But pray for her. But you know, I'm here to share my journey as someone who converted from Islam to Christianity, became a disciple. And let me ask you a question: what's the big deal about someone converting from Islam to Christianity? You know, now if a Buddhist converts, you know, we say no big deal, right? If an atheist converts, maybe, you know, okay. But if a Muslim, oh, look out, you know, a Muslim converted, you know, so that's a big deal. Well, it's, I think it's a big deal because it's not, like Dan was sharing earlier, it's not about people who are of Muslim, but it's the system. Because it's one of the only religions that teaches that you should kill somebody if they convert the religion. So I think that's why it becomes a big deal sometimes. And don't get me wrong, I have members of my family that are Muslim. I love them. We get along just fine. You know, most of the people in this world, you know, they want to live in peace and they want to mind their own business. You know, but there are some fanatics, you know, some might think differently. To some of them I may be labeled as an apostate. That's what it's called when you convert from Islam to Christianity, as you're an apostate. And my wife and I have this running joke is that, I'm an apostate and I married an infidel. So she says the furnace is going to be fired like 10 times hotter for, you know, for me, you know, when they throw me in. So it's a little joke we have going on. But, anyway, a little about my background. I was born in a small town called Birjan. That's in the southeast of Iran. And, I grew up in a pre-revolutionary days when Iran was a monarchy and the Shah ruled Iran. If some of you study history, you know about that. My family is actually from Tehran, but my dad was in the military, so we actually were stationed in different cities, so we moved around quite a bit. And that's why I was born in Birjan. And I had never heard... the only religion I had heard about in Iran is Islam. I had never heard about the Bible or about Christianity. I had no idea. The only thing that we were introduced to was Islam. But see, my dad was not so much religious. I think it was the Hanif, or what do you call that, when someone who just believes in Hanif. Yeah, it's kind of like that. He never pushed religion on us. He said, hey, just believe in God. That's all you need. But I remember being a kid going to the mosque with my dad, you know, visiting the mosque. And so, you know, it's that's the only thing I knew about, like, you know, God was, or what religion was. You know, I didn't realize at this time, but God had a plan for my life, you know, at this time. So in 1978, my father sent us here to the U.S. because of this uncertainty that was going on. You know, there was turmoil in the government. And you know, in 1979, the Islamic Revolution happened. So we came here in 78, 79, Islamic Revolution. So that forever changed the course of our lives, of my life personally. For better or worse, we were now forced to stay here and could not go back. When the war with Iraq broke out, and some of you might have, you know, read about that, hundreds of thousands of young people died on both sides in that war, both Iran and Iraq. So we were very lucky to have been shielded from that. I had cousins who lived in Iran, and most of them got out. You know, their parents sent them to, like, Germany. They just got out. One of my cousins was in the war. He survived, but he's, to this day, he has the PTSD from all the people that he saw, you know, die in that war and the horrors that he experienced. I really thank God for God putting on my dad's heart to make the decision he did. You know, it's not easy to uproot your family and move to a different country. But I didn't realize it at that time, but God had a plan, like I said, you know. And I was 8 years old when we came here to the U.S., along with my brothers and my sister. And growing up here wasn't easy. You know, many of you know that during the revolution in Iran, American hostages were taken. And there was also an oil shortage in the U.S. at that time. Many Americans blamed OPEC and the Middle Eastern countries. Needless to say, I had a very tough time. My brother and I were verbally harassed. We got into many fights at school. People would follow us in the streets and call us every name in the book. In the sixth grade, one of my best friends disowned me because he was getting persecuted for being my friend. And eventually, the hatred I was experiencing began to take its toll. At that point, I even felt lied about being Iranian because I was so ashamed. And I didn't realize it this time, but God still had a plan. When we came here, my understanding was that this is a Christian nation. So many of us, maybe the same people who went, you know, who were mistreating us were the same ones that were going to church with their family on Sunday. So I decided that if this is Christianity, I won't have nothing to do with this. And I also wasn't too crazy about Islam or any other religion either. Just want to be clear about that. But I decided that I'm just going to live my life and enjoy myself. You know, but as I grew older, I began to feel the need for something more. In 1990, I was living in Orange County, and in my freshman year in college, God worked and allowed me to get a New Testament Bible through a friend. So it was the very first time in my life that I had opened and read the words of Jesus. I fell in love with the stories, and God began to move my heart. A year later, I was met by Chris Chang, who was from this ministry. He was part of the mission team from here, San Diego, sent to Orange County to help with the start a campus ministry. So that's who met me at the Bible talk I went to. Chris became a great friend very quickly. It took me only 7 days before I was baptized. That was back in 1991. 25 years. Thanks. Thank you. 25 years later, and Chris and I are still best friends. God inspired me to and put it on my heart to go on a mission team. I was part of the planning in Istanbul Church in 1995. I lived there for 3 years in Turkey. One of my dreams was to start a ministry in Ephesus, which is called Izmir today. I visited there once, and I was able to go see the city, but it wasn't the right time for me. I wasn't ready spiritually to do that. And one of my dreams is to go back someday to Turkey and see Izmir again and visit my brothers and sisters in the Istanbul Church. For the sake of time, I've had to skip over many of the other details of my conversion and my journey. In recent years, Marie and I have fallen in love with Christian apologetics. We have come to classes and have learned many great things from our from brothers like John Oakes, Doug Jacoby, Dan Condor, Kedrin Jones, and many others. We began passing on what we've learned to the teens in our ministry. We created apologetics lessons tailored for them. One of the first lessons that I learned in the apologetics classes was the understanding of the worldview. And I'm sure John will probably talk more about that. But when we understand someone else's worldview, we understand the person. Then we can relate to them and help them in a much more effective way. This is how Paul was able to relate to the Athenians and teach them about the unknown God in Acts 17. But the thing that I want to emphasize is this. The main problem isn't how to convert a non-believer to come to faith in Christ. Even someone like me who is from a Muslim background, the real issue is how to keep that individual to stay faithful. Yeah. You know, you see, there are not too many of us around in the church who converted from Islam to Christianity. There was a time in my walk where I felt very alone. You know, even though I was never alone, God was with me. But the Christian faith isn't a solo act. You know, we need connections and relationships. Yes, I'm an American, and very grateful to be living here, but also I have my Iranian heritage, you know, which is part of me, part of who I am. You know, I can't just turn that off, you know. And so my wife and I, we recently got moved to Orange County. I'm originally from there, but we're living in L.A. We moved to Orange County, back to Orange County. Now, there's a small Persian congregation that meets near where we live. I've been visiting their services on Sunday afternoon. So, you know, our services are in Cerritos in the morning, so it works out good. You know, perfect. I go in the afternoons to visit them. And, you know, my purpose to go there is to fellowship and encourage them. You know, they're not part of our, you know, church or part of ICOC, but I go there because I want to fellowship and encourage other people who've had the courage to convert, you know, to Christianity, and just a fellowship. So my final thought is this: I really encourage you to wrap your arms around disciples who've converted to Christianity from other religions, especially Islam. Really encourage them. If you know of any, you know, congregations that meet, you know, go and meet them, fellowship with them, encourage them, and really love them. Love is really what's going to help people from my background become disciples. Really, that's the key. The medicine for hatred is love, right? You fight hate with love. So that's it. That's my story. And thank you for letting me speak. Appreciate it. Yeah.
And I'm going to talk about apologetics in Islam after the break.
Sure. Oh, sorry.
Thank you so much for sharing. Very inspiring.
Good job. Oh, thank you, bro. Sorry this came off.
What came off? Oh, that's okay.
No problem. It's still on.
I'm going to get, are you actually?